Welcome to Context and Clarity. How'd I do, Karen?
You did good.
All right. Nice first job. Time we got to say that.
Yeah.
I am Chuck.
And I am Karen.
I used to be a Democrat.
I used to be a Republican.
I am still a liberal.
And I'm still a conservative. But now that our parties have left us, we're not really sure what we are. But we do know this. As Abraham Lincoln reminds us, we are not enemies. We are friends.
We are friends. And we're about a year into this podcast. And
we are.
We made some changes and we're still friends.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing.
I did not think I could be a friend with a conservative for a year.
But you did. Look at you. I'm proud of you.
Well, I'm tolerant. I'm a tolerant man.
Yes, you are nothing if not tolerant. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, as many of you have noticed, and the rest of you soon will notice, we've decided to change the name of the show from Rants and Reason to Context and Clarity. There are several reasons for the name change. First of all, the show took an organic direction that was a bit different from where we started. Also, we believe people are really tired of ranting, and we found that once we really researched an issue, we were kind of humbled to the point that it was really hard to get up the indignation to rant. Now, Chuck can usually get up the indignation to rant over anything, but...
Oh, I can still rant.
But the main reason we changed our name was because we realized that what we were really doing was going on a quest for political truth and asking all of you to join us. But then we had to ask ourselves, how does one actually discover political truth?
Well, and we're going to jump around a little bit, but we're going to start by discussing last week's State of the Union. Now, after the presidential address, many news sites and political bloggers immediately began the work of fact-checking, ourselves included. But then we widened our lens and came to some bigger realizations. First, let's discuss the historical structure of the State of the Union Address. The address is made up of three parts: meditations on values, assessment of information, and issues and policy recommendations. Now, the usual themes of the speech also come in a set of three, the first being past and future, second being bipartisanship, and the third, optimism. Now, State of the Unions are also historically known for the introduction of a major policy proposal, which this particular one didn't have. Now, the president touched on policy proposals that we were already familiar with, but he didn't really broach a whole lot of new territory in it.
In Trump's speech, most of the usual elements were there, but it kind of seemed all disjointed, and we think this is why. The overriding themes that the writers appeared to want to convey were bipartisanship, unity, and common ground. But in doing that, there was actually very little discussed that most Americans wanted to hear about. We hear the word unity tossed around a lot. But we propose that unity is nowhere near a solution to the current political division. Neither is common ground. Now, before we move forward, we want to own that in the beginning of our show, we said the exact opposite. When we first decided to do a podcast, we talked a lot about common ground. But as Chuck pointed out to me once, brilliant man that he is, common ground really wasn't our goal because common ground isn't really standing for anything, and that isn't how either one of us approaches politics.
Now, what do we mean when we say the common ground doesn't really stand for anything? Let's go back to the State of the Union. The president brought up many issues that hopefully we can all agree on, such as eradicating AIDS and childhood cancer. Now, that is common ground. While working together to solve these problems is a very positive thing, focusing the speech on issues like that attempted to avoid the issues that we struggle to find consensus on. Webster defines common ground as opinions or interests shared by each of two or more parties. Common ground isn't hard. It also doesn't solve many of the problems outside of the ones we all share concerns or interests in. Finding common ground with our political opponents is a good thing in relationship building. It's a good thing in maintaining a cohesive society, It simply isn't all that helpful in crafting meaningful and sustaining policy.
Back to our goals with the podcast. We realize that we both have very concrete ideas and principles, and those ideas don't always find common ground. While we tried very hard to find points of convergence, what we figured out along the way was those points of convergence came where we agreed to a common set of facts. We thought if people could take those facts and find a way to compromise, that that would be the solution. And compromise can really be beneficial. In fact, compromise is absolutely essential to a functioning government. And some of the more effective and sustaining policies are bipartisan ones shaped by the tool of compromise. However, it's only one tool in the toolbox, and not one that always reflects the will of the people. Compromise is not necessarily a representative action unless we start to demand it, which I personally would like to see more of.
And there is a reason, Karen, that we have two political parties, right? There's a reason that candidates run on a platform. What is that reason? It's because we don't all agree on what should be done, how it should be done, or when it should be done, or how much we want to spend to have it done.
Right.
So, for example, the right wants lower taxes, the left wants a stronger safety net by raising taxes. How do you come to an agreement? Common ground or compromise alone will not get it done.
And that takes us back to the whole common set of facts thing. So as a podcast, we started focusing on that, facts. If we could all just disseminate facts, we could start to solve the problems.
But then we encountered a major obstacle, the definition and manipulation of facts. First of all, one has to deal with the almost philosophical problem of defining a fact. Now, Webster defines a fact as something that has actual existence, which is pretty vague and pretty open to perception. Now, other definitions state a fact as something that exists with evidence to support it, that existence. So, going by these definitions, there are facts flying everywhere. In a term I coined, we are all being accosted by fact blizzards.
The internet has singular facts flying at us all the time. With people being generally blind to their own bias, it's really easy to grab one of those facts and then present it as truth. And then we share that truth. We all have bias blindness when it comes to ourselves. We see it in each other, but we don't want to admit that we have it.
For example, Karen, I will take any fact that makes Reagan look like a horrible president and store it away for later use. I imagine he did something good as president, but I choose to forget those things. I know more details about the Iran-Contra thing than Ollie North did. I mean, if you want to talk about Reagan, I will talk all day about the Iran-Contra thing. I know it inside and out because I grab every fact about it to prove what a shady guy Reagan was. Facts and the truth are not the same thing. But we're going to go into that in a few minutes.
Well, then you have deliberate manipulation of the singular and biased facts. The internet made this so, so much easier. Consider that there are 214 million Facebook users in the U.S. You have the greater population of the U.S. on that platform. And like Chuck often says, internet lies are like herpes, except you can give them to about a million people at once. As we've talked about it before on previous episodes, lies travel about 3 times faster on the internet. A study done by Stanford University identified 570 fake news sites, sites dedicated to disseminate false information on Facebook and Twitter. They found that every story produced by these sites averaged over 100 Facebook engagements. That would be likes, comments, stuff like that, and 10 Twitter retweets. This may not sound like much until you consider that there were about 10,240 false stories published by those sites from 2016 to 2018. And they are only using data on the known fake news sites. The study didn't even account for the individually created memes.
Well, so let's go back to facts and truth. Again, a fact is its own thing. It can be a statistic, a study conclusion, a physical representation. But it's incomplete and rather useless without context. context is what can turn a fact into truth. And do you remember when we were doing the war on drugs, and we got to the criminal justice system?
Yeah.
And we were using the sentencing project's statistics?
Yes.
And we found out that those were facts, but taken out of context to present to make a greater truth that was, in fact, not true.
Right. Right.
You remember what that was? Everybody in jail, they counted in prison and blah, blah, blah. They
didn't take jail churn into consideration. Right.
Technically, they were accurate. It was a fact, but it was not a truth.
Exactly. So think of simple sentence structure. A complete sentence is made up of two essential parts, right? A subject and a predicate. Facts are the subject and context is the predicate. Context is what activates the fact and gives it strength and meaning. Really take a second and let that sink in. In most of today's political discourse, we haven't been speaking in complete sentences, so no wonder we can't hear each other. We're all throwing out facts, but facts without context. History helps provide that context. So, armed with both, one can finally start to cut through the fog of ideology to see political truth. That is ultimately why we changed our name. We need context to provide some clarity.
Amen.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.